Commander Edmunds Reel 2.
Yes, the pilot escaped, but the air crewman, unfortunately, was drowned. The pilot was picked up by... He fired his flares, and I've forgotten which ship picked him up now. Probably one of the Type 12s. So it was on the 1st of May we entered the exclusion zone, the 200-mile exclusion zone. At that time, we were being shadowed by a Argentinian fishing boat called the Narwhal, and there was some doubt as to what its role was. And caused the flagship in considerable trouble as to what they should do with it. The general aggressive opinion was, of course, that it was reporting our movements and that it should be sunk. But there was a certain reluctance in the early days to take aggressive action in case that was misread. And so this perishing fishing boat was allowed to bob around for a number of days, hovering on the edge of our activity, being able to report what we were up to. And eventually it was sorted out, but a few days later. I think in the early days in the exclusion zone, it was not totally clear what the rules of engagement were, that what was behind the rules of engagement that were applying to us at the time. And with the wisdom of hindsight and knowing now what was going on the flagship, I'm well aware now that it was a tussle for to allow the politicians to permit us to deal with incidents, particularly like this fishing boat, as they occurred, as we saw fit at the time. But the politicians, not being very confident in us, didn't want us to become too aggressive whilst Mr. Haig was doing his shuttle and they were organising political support from the common market and NATO and all the rest of it.
And then the next thing?
Well, notwithstanding the fishing boat, it was quite clear that from the 1st of May and in the exclusion zone that our rules of engagement were very much freer than when we were out of it. I think one of the things that was clear to us, but not clear to the rest of the world, is that in the exclusion zone we were permitted to attack anything that we felt was threatening us, if it appeared to be Argentinian. Essentially, we were in the exclusion zone at war. But outside the exclusion zone, we were allowed to attack anything that interfered with our operations, if it was Argentinian. And this, whilst it was clear to me, it was clearly not clear to other people around the world, because later press reports indicated that the Argentinians felt that if they were operating outside 200 miles, then they wouldn't be attacked. And that clearly was not true. Had any Argentinian come close to us anywhere in the world and started to interfere in what we were doing, we had the right to, under our rules of engagement, to attack it. And that didn't seem to be understood. But on the 1st of May, we actually started a number of activities to, I suppose, spice things up. And these, the very first incident, as I remember it, was the Glamorgan Alacrity in the Arrow going inshore off Stanley to start naval gunfire support. And that did draw in the first air attacks from southern Argentina. And they were attacked, I can't remember by which sort of aircraft, whether Mirage or Daggers, which is the Israeli Mirage 5, which the Argentinians had, or by Skyhawks. But nevertheless, they were attacked by about four aircraft. And the first sort of proper injury was then occurred because the Arrow's 20mm cannon gunner was firing back at the attacking aircraft as they came in. And one of them, and they were firing their own cannon at the ship. And he was hit by a splinter. And that, I think that woke up our gun screws to the fact that this was going to be a fairly basic war of gun versus gun and perhaps simple missile versus aeroplane. And that the enemy would be firing at us as we fired at him. The young man, he was only 18, wasn't seriously hurt, but nevertheless he collected a splinter somewhere in his shoulder, I think. There was also great concern early on about the Argentinian submarines. They didn't have very many. They had two reasonably modern ones, which were German type 209 submarines, and they had some old American guppy class. One of those we knew was didn't work. The other one had been dealt with in South Georgia. And that left just the two 209s. Intelligence told us that one was in port in Argentina, but the other one was at sea. And there were indications that it was operating off the north coast of East Falkland. And the Brilliant and the Yarmouth and some Sea King were sent close inshore to try and catch it. I believe that actually it was there, and Yarmouth and Brilliant and the Sea Kings did have some success in giving him quite a hard time. But the 209 is a very good little submarine, and the Argentinian captain was able to avoid most of the attacks and detection. But it was sufficient to shake him that his whereabouts were roughly known, and that we were able to be quite aggressive in sending two surface ships in with three aeroplanes to deal with him. And after a couple of days, the Brilliant and the Yarmouth came back, and the submarine returned to Argentina. What we were not to know, of course, was that at the time, was that they were having considerable difficulty with the torpedoes, and they hadn't perfected a method of firing them particularly well. And indeed, the other 209 fired its torpedoes, and they got stuck coming out of the torpedo tubes. And that really the submarine threat was minimal. At that time, we didn't believe that it was, but as time went on and they never reappeared, and then we got decent intelligence, we realized that this ASW was not going to be a major part of our lives. There were other events that day, and I can't particularly remember them that well. But certainly, a number of aircraft were shot down by Sea Harriers. And there were early Sea Harrier attacks on places like Goose Green.
And the next day?
Well, the 2nd of May was quite a quiet day. I think it was a surprise for everybody to actually be involved in a shooting war. And the Argentinians did seem to work day on, day off. Now, one of the advantages that we had is that we maintained Greenwich Mean Time. So that meant at a time zone that was 4 hours late that we actually got up as far as the Argentinians were concerned at 4 o'clock in the morning. And this is probably a significant factor because as we got up at 4 o'clock local time, which was 8 o'clock Zulu time, and had breakfast at 4 o'clock in the morning, we could then get the ship right, do the system checks, all in the dark. And by the time daylight came up, it would be midday, and we were having lunch while the Argentinians were getting up and having breakfast and doing their pre-flight briefs. So we had, we gave ourselves, by working Zulu time, a four-hour period in which to prepare ourselves. And we had worked Zulu time since we left the UK. Now, of course, in a ship with no windows, no scuttles, you know, it's just dark inside. So all we did was maintain the lighting to match our time zone. And that was significant because we were ready to fight at midday, having had 4 hours to get ready. Whereas the Argentinians arrived with sleep in their eyes, for want of a better word. And we fought in the afternoon, and the dog watchers, and they fought in the forenoon and the afternoon. And as they had very little capability of fighting at night, we then had a decent night's sleep for the next day. And therefore, it seemed to be that the Argentinians had peaks and troughs of activity, and they could mount major attacks on one day, but that would exhaust them for the next 2 days. And, of course, what happened after the first day when they put up quite an effort to drive us out, doubtless being reported by this fishing boat, the Narwhal, on the second day, not very much happened at all. And, of course, on the third day, the Belgrano was sunk. And we used Lynx helicopters to also go for some patrol boats and what we considered to be an intelligence ship called the Iguza, and the patrol boat was called the Sobral, which was sunk, and the Iguza was damaged by Lynx helicopters using CSQR missiles.
You said there was this advantage of using Zulu instead of local time, but was there the disadvantage later in the day when you were ready for bed and the Argentinians had another 4 hours?
No, not really, because obviously it would get dark at what would be 6 o'clock local time. When it went dark, it would be 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening to us. So essentially our fighting day started at midday and ended at 8. Bear in mind it was heading into southern autumn and winter. So activity was midday to 8 o'clock in the evening. And so between lunch and supper, we fought our war, and then between supper and lunch, we rested and got ready for the next day. And that was probably quite significant in the way we ran day-to-day life.
And the next thing?
After the sinking of the Belgrano, which of course gave us all quite some time for thought. We were very well aware at the time that there were two Argentinian, if not three Argentinian, task groups at sea. South of the Falklands was the Belgrano with, I can't remember, 6-inch or 8-inch guns, but bigger guns than we had, and Exocet missiles. She might be an old ship, but she had good guns, good missiles, and two destroyers also with Exocet missiles. North of the Falklands, just north of Falklands, was a group of Argentinian A-69 frigates, corvettes, once again armed with Exocets, and they're French built. They have a sort of 4-inch gun on the front and missiles. And then further north again was the 25th of May aircraft carrier with her Type 42 escorts, the Argentinian Type 42 escorts, and I think two more destroyers. And it was quite clear to anybody who could read the general operations plot in our ops room, which was everybody on board, that they were trying to execute a very classic pincer movement. And you didn't need intelligence reports to tell us that. And even a stoker coming in the ops room to see what was going on could see it. And at one stage, I think we estimated they were only 80 miles away from us. Now, to a politician who looks at a range of a missile being only 25 or 30 miles, which is Exocet, 80 miles is probably, as far as he's concerned, out of range. But at a combined closing speed of 60 knots, that's only an hour steaming. And it was then that people on board got slightly anxious, because it was quite clear that the two nuclear submarines, Conqueror to the south, and I can't remember which one to the north, were in contact with the 25th of May and the Belgrano, but were clearly not free to attack. And it was a bit of a puzzle why, because clearly they were mounting an attack upon us. They were going to interfere with our operations. The last thing we wanted was to get into an exchange of missiles before we were able to launch airstrikes or submarine attacks upon them. Quite simply, I mean, the last thing you want to do is have a surface ship to surface ship engagement, because that's even odds, and that you want to hold off your enemy and attack him at range. So you do that with submarines and aeroplanes. And nothing was happening. And that was giving us cause for concern, because we weren't quite sure what was in the Admiral's mind. He must have been as aware of the situation as we were. And, of course, I now know that he was manipulating the politicians and the Commander-in-Chief to allow him to attack the 25th of May and the Belgrano. And therefore, when the Belgrano was sunk, there was immense relief, because that spiked their attack. And it soon became very clear that the submarine to the north had lost contact with the 25th of May whilst trying to receive the permissive order to attack the 25th of May. But it didn't really matter, because the Argentinians literally just left the sea, and they never went outside their surface ships, their significant surface ships, never went outside the 12-mile limit ever again. They were more conscious of our submarine threat to them than they were seemed to be prepared to make a submarine threat to us. And that sinking of the Belgrano was a tactically significant move, which every sailor in the fleet realized that had essentially put the Argentinian fleet in port forever. And that gave us much more freedom to maneuver. So after Belgrano, the next thing was the appearance of the RAF. Now, I don't suppose it's any secret that there is not a lot of love lost between the Air Force and the Navy. And that, as far as we were concerned, that this was essentially a naval operation. It was the Royal Navy and the Royal Marines with the paras. That said, of course, there were a number of RAF pilots flying with naval air squadrons, and there were five GR3 Harriers on the Hermes. But that was the sum of it. They were either on exchange or attached to, and it was a very much naval battle. And the appearance, I mean, it was exciting that the Vulcan was going to fly all the way down, and it was clearly a major operational achievement. I've forgotten how many 1,000-pound bombs these things carry, 24 or whatever. And we were confident that they would do something to stand the airfield to close it. And I think they were called, the code name for the flights were Black Buck. And knowing that how the operation was going to run, there were a large number of people stayed up overnight just to, you know, hear the news and to watch this big aeroplane arrive, fly over us and head down towards Stanley. And it was with, you can imagine, the pleasure that the RAF claimed that they, you know, had bombed the runway and had been successful. And then the dismay to find that out of the 24 bombs, only one had hit the runway, because the method of bombing they chose meant that of 24 bombs dropped, they were only estimating that two or three would hit the runway anyway, and only one did, and it hit the edge of the runway, and the Argentinians proved themselves quite adept at flying around the crater. And we thought it was an immense amount of effort to prove that the Air Force could do something when clearly they arrived all the way down there and didn't. We weren't sure that the diversion of assets to something with a low chance of success was actually worth it.
Next?
Well, the weather, I think, is the thing that people always consider with the Falklands, and it does have a reputation for, particularly as winter comes on, high winds and high seas. But to be absolutely truthful, from the time we left Gibraltar to the time we got back, we only had 8 days that I would have considered rough. And the weather was, if the original description was correct, was quite unseasonal. And generally, most days, it was flat calm with blue skies. And, of course, when you're vulnerable to air attack, that's the last thing you want. And even worse, if you have gas turbine engines, particularly Olympus, which are quite smoky, the air goes up, the gas efflux goes up, and with the ship at full speed, will leave a very distinctive cloud behind you, which the Sea Harrier pilots told us could be seen from at least 60 miles away. So all they used to do was to look for a plume of gas turbine smoke, and you at the bottom of it would be a ship. And the only variation in the weather we would get was when there would be poor visibility, because this rather unseasonable, slightly warmer, flat seas, isothermal temperatures and so forth, we would then get fog. We were always particularly conscious that our masts might be sticking above the fog. And it was on the, I think the 5th of May, that we had this quite a lot of poor visibility. I think the significant thing was it was the 4th or 5th of May that the Sheffield, of course, was hit by the Exocet attack. At that stage, we had shaken the task force, the carrier task force, down into its almost permanent formation it would remain in for the rest of the war, which was with three Type 42s to the west, providing sort of being air defense pickets. And then about 20, 25 miles in from the screen of those, and they ran on a north-south line, about 25 miles to the east of those would then be the screen of SW ships, and then behind them the aircraft carriers and the auxiliaries. What was significant, particularly about the attack on the Sheffield, is we hadn't really shaken out our air defense and air traffic control procedures as well as we might. The problem with losing the big fixed-wing aircraft carriers is that our skills in air defense operations with our own aircraft had been reduced. The old HMS Ark Royal had gone around about 1977-78, and they were quickly bringing on Invincible and Illustrious, and Hermes had been fitted out with a ramp but was still essentially being used for amphibious and ASW type operations. And that 3 or 4 years was crucial in just taking the edge off running our own air defense. Up north, the RAF had tended to become involved, and RAF air defense is quite a bureaucratic operation. If it's your own aeroplanes providing your own air defense, the reactions would be very much quicker. The significance of that really appeared on the attack on the Sheffield. Without a shadow of a doubt, the Glasgow, who was the northern ship of the three Type 42s on air defense picket duty, detected two unknown aircraft coming towards her from the west-northwest. And knowing where our own air defense cap were, she put them out on the data link, which was Link 10 in those days, as hostile interceptors. And that very quickly went round the data link, and I remember seeing it appearing in our own computer system, which sent us to action stations, and indeed, as far as I know, other ships went to action stations as well. The two Argentinian Etendards then headed south, and they were picked up by the Coventry, who took them on, tracking them, and they then disappeared southwards. Presumably they turned in and had actually detected the task force and were looking for an easy way to come in and attack us. But it was at that stage that the Force Anti-Air Warfare Coordinator, who coordinates the activities of air defense aircraft, air defense missile systems, and so forth, declared that the two hostile interceptors that Glasgow had put into our data link system were in fact returning friendly Sea Harriers. When Sheffield received them, we in Broadsword doubted that considerably. We knew what time the Sea Harriers were due to return, and it didn't tie in with him calling that the Sea Harriers were coming back. So we remained at action stations. We didn't have a lot of faith in some of the early assessments of aircraft movements, if they were in doubt, by the flagship, or by Invincible, in fact, who was running air defense. And we remained at action stations, but Sheffield took Invincible's word for it, and promptly, because they had some signal traffic to transmit on their satellite comm system, transmitted on satellite communications, which interfered with their UAA-1 electronic surveillance equipment, and significantly blanked out about 7.8 to 8.2 gigahertz, which is the frequency range over which the Exocet radar works. And indeed, the AGARV radar in the front of the Etendards. So that when the two Etendards popped up, turned their radars on to look at the fleet, the ship closest to them in the air defense line didn't detect their radar, and nor did it detect the launch of the missiles. And the Argentinians, unfortunately, of course, had chosen to target the missiles at the first ship they saw, which was the Sheffield, which was 20 miles further away from the main body of ships. And so really the main body of ships weren't, in theory, in any danger, because the range of an Exocet launched from that height is not very far. And anyway, of course, the Sheffield was hit by one missile, we think, certainly one, if not two. And, of course, she caught fire very quickly. And because they had relaxed at just that moment, and a colleague of mine who was also the operations officer and responsible for air defense, had left the ops room to go to the bridge, they were significantly less prepared than other people who were, like us, who were waiting to see, because we were not confident in the assessment from a flagship. Anyway, Sheffield was hit, and we moved down to assist, and it was the Arrow and the Yarmouth who went down to actually get right close to shield Sheffield. And things got a little bit exciting then, because Sheffield was on fire. Their ship's company were driven out from below decks, those that a majority of them had survived. And they started a shuttle of taking those who were badly burnt off the Sheffield and taking them over to the Hermes. And the two supporting frigates, Yarmouth and Arrow, went round and round and round the Sheffield, and they put Geminis in the water to get more fire pumps over, emergency pumps, because Sheffield had lost her diesel generators and therefore couldn't fight the fire from her own resources. And then we were at the time still worried about the Argentinian submarine, the 209 that had been chased 2 or 3 days before. And the noise, unfortunately, of the Gemini engines in the water convinced a sonar operator that he'd heard a torpedo. So that started a sort of minor ASW action going on at the same time. And it degenerated into a little bit of a panic. It was eventually resolved, and the two frigates took off the ship's company, and eventually Sheffield was just allowed to burn itself out. And that took some time. Probably, as I remember, about 3 or 4 days. And it, because of the doubt of about the submarine, it was felt we couldn't leave resources down there to help the Sheffield and become sitting targets. So the decision was made to abandon the Sheffield and withdraw. And that's what we did. And it was actually flat calm sea, and she just sat there burning merrily. And each day, engineers went down to see how it was going, expecting huge explosions and so forth, but she had just smouldered away. And there was a hole in the side some 5 or 6 feet above the waterline. Still going. 5 or 6 feet above the waterline. And that was fine. In the end, it was decided to leave Sheffield as a trap to see if the Argentinians would bring a submarine up to either sink it, or even better, put someone on board to see if they could find anything of use. That didn't work, and so the decision was made for Yarmouth to tow the Sheffield to South Georgia, where she could either be salvaged or sunk or have some record made of the damage for further use after the war. But of course, towing her south, the sea got up, the water went in the hole, and she sank. It should be realized that exocets are not designed to sink ships. They're actually designed to damage them. And it's been proven a number of times since, an exocet will make a hole, set fire to a ship. And if you can contain the fire, then you can actually save your ship.